Hey, it's Matt. The coronavirus pandemic is taking up a lot of space right now in our minds and in the news. And we'd like to use some time on All In to cover other things that are happening. So we thought we'd revisit this show from earlier this month, an in-depth academic look at how the Midwest, where we live, is portrayed in movies and TV. Our guest has been studying this for most of his career, and it was an eye-opening discussion. Since today's show is an encore presentation, we can't take your questions or comments, but we would always love to hear from you. Of course, we will be covering the coronavirus as it relates to Indiana as confirmed cases continue to rise, but we'll devote some shows to non-COVID-19 subjects as well. What should we be covering to distract you from the pandemic for an hour? We have a few ideas of our own, but you can send us yours on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. The American Midwest has been the setting for countless books, movies, and TV shows. But how often do they get it right? What kind of picture do these pieces of fiction paint of the place we call home? Today, we welcome Adam O'Connicky, a lecturer of English at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh and the author of the new book, The American Midwest in Film and Literature, Nostalgia, Violence, and Regionalism. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me. I'm happy to be here with you.
Adam, you open the book with a reference to, of all things, an Onion article.
Yes.
What was that article, and why do you want to use it?
So it's an article that's been published and then republished in The Onion several times over the past 20, 25 years. For those who aren't familiar, The Onion is a satirical newspaper that was founded out of Madison, Wisconsin. So it has Midwestern origins, and it's sort of publication that regularly satirizes American culture with a particular eye towards its region of origin, the Midwest. It used to be a weekly publication. Now it's transferred to online format. And that article was simply titled Midwest Discovered Between East West Coasts. And so for me, this was kind of it perfectly encapsulated many of the things that I was trying to work on in this project. The sense of the Midwest as this mysterious, unknown place that to outsiders, to those who aren't from here, they maybe pass over, right? We have the flyover country as being this standard default label that's affixed to the central region. And the Onion article really plays with those stereotypes, including the stereotypes of elitist East Coasters. So it's in short form, a work that kind of encompasses a lot of different dynamics that were of interest to me, from cultural stereotypes to a sort of sense of abstraction that's projected onto the Midwest. And that's something that really carries throughout my book, is thinking of how the Midwest is this malleable object, that it has clear geographic parameters, but it's something that can be twisted and distorted to mean a lot of different things, depending on the context, depending on the time in history when people are talking about the Midwest, and so on. So one of the nice things for me about the book was that this opening, you know, satirical piece as a sort of symmetrical analogy with, you know, just recent political coverages of the Midwest, that suddenly the Midwest is this region that's been discovered over the last 5+ years due to its prominence in national election cycles.
And you're a lecturer at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh, but are you yourself from the Midwest?
I am. So I grew up in St. Louis, South St. Louis in the city, and then my family moved out to the western parameters of the St. Louis area. So I'd experienced living in both a city environment and a more rural environment. And I think that background, that life experience, really helped me to think more broadly about all the different facets of Midwestern culture instead of just defaulting to the standard rural image that's often lumped onto the region to the exclusion of all of its cities and urban places. As a just quick note, when I moved to Wisconsin, it was interesting to me just how even within the Midwest, there's a clear lack of definition of what the region is, that often my students or sometimes colleagues would say that I was from the South, that St. Louis was perceived as being a Southern city, Missouri is a Southern state. And so those kinds of dynamics were always fascinating, where boundaries begin to blur and dissolve between different locales, different types of places.
I'd have to admit that I kind of share that same view of Missouri as being the South, but it's kind of right there in the middle, where maybe portions of the state could be the South and portions could be the Midwest. You being from there, how do you see it?
I really do think that Missouri is one of those divided areas, and it kind of happens on several boundaries of the Midwest. So on the eastern boundary, Ohio is a state that, for some folks reads perhaps more as East Coast in some parts, although the western side of Pennsylvania perhaps reads more as Midwestern than it does East Coast. Like, I have a friend from Pittsburgh who always spoke about how he seemed to feel a little bit more Midwestern than an Easterner. I would say for my own project, I just began with a kind of default, for lack of a better word, definition of the Midwest. And the U.S. Census Bureau identifies four regions within the nation: the Midwest, Northeast, South, and West. And the Midwest, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, is composed of 12 states. So I just used that as a starting point and said, okay, when I'm trying to find narratives, stories about the region, I at least need to confirm that they're taking place, that they're unfolding within one of those 12 states. And from there, I can just see what kinds of ideas and dynamics unfold, what kinds of understandings of what the Midwest is are presented to us through those types of settings.
I grew up 10 minutes from the Ohio border, and a lot of my friends are from Ohio. And so this idea that Ohio is East Coast is very, very foreign to me for anyone who might be wondering that sort of thing. We are talking to Adam O'Connicky, a lecturer of English at the University of Wisconsin and author of the new book, The American Midwest in Film and Literature. What made you want to look into this?
It really was a combination of both professional and personal concerns and interest that, on one level, as I was trying to sort of develop a book project, there seemed to be a consistent lack of discussion of the Midwest across a variety of different academic disciplines. Historian John Locke, who's a colleague of mine on Midwest Review, he's currently the editor-in-chief, he wrote a book entitled The Lost Region to describe the Midwest. That the Midwest, according to Locke, is, he puts it, a ghost among regions that's been lost to the popular and historical imagination. And that phrasing really resonated. And it's this area, this, both cultural and geographic entity that has been under-discussed, both in historical context and in some of my own areas, which is film and literary studies and cultural studies, American studies, and so on. And so I saw a real opportunity for me to intervene and to shine a light on something that's actually been happening throughout the history of, say, American cinema. And that is that there's this ongoing examination of regional identity within this medium, something that hasn't been talked about by many others. There's one terrific study of the Midwest in television, Heartland TV by Victoria Johnson. But in the film context, it's been more sporadic, an article here or there, but not that sort of large-scale study of just how the region has been rendered in film, and particularly American film. And some of that was inspired too by, I had a few mentors who did similar work in grad school. One mentor, Patrice Pietro, she did this wonderful study of Weimar-era Germany and how film gave insights into the cultural dynamics of that period. And another, Andrew Kincaid, is an Irish studies scholar, and how sort of works of literature and other cultural objects give insights into the post-colonial experience of Ireland. So just having those backgrounds in mind and thinking of how can looking at works in popular culture, looking at cultural objects, how can those things help us to understand place identity, the ways in which associations with place and region and identity might impact the lives of the people living within those territories, or just the lives of the folks surrounding those territories. So that's where the professional side of things began for me.
Why do you think that the American Midwest has been under-discussed?
It's something that has long had this identity that seems just sort of taken for granted. It's there. In some of my research, I would find historians writing about this very dynamic, that question of why isn't there more? And some folks, Andrew Caden is a major historian of the Midwest, and he writes about how the region has been perceived as an anti-region, that it doesn't really cling together. Other folks, like journalist Richard Longworth, has this notion that the Midwestern states don't really cling together, that they're just kind of distinct from one another. And maybe that's part of the initial merging of the Midwest from the old Northwest territories, the sort of Great Lakes states, and the Great Plains territories, which can feel very different from one another. and yet they're all lumped together as being this central region. So in my work, the sort of standard is that the Midwest has congealed in a national imagination, in American popular imagination, around 1912 or so. So early 20th century, people began to have this sense of the Midwest as roughly this 12-state region. And of course, again, where those parameters precisely sit vary depending on one's perspective. Whether Missouri, for instance, is part of the Midwest or not can vary depending on where one's located within the region. But that's where this origin begins, over 100 years ago. And I think over time, it was just sort of, again, this place that has devolved into having a blank identity, that it can mean the most authentic region, the most real place in the country, which I always think is a fascinating and kind of troubling notion, as well as the nondescript place that's unremarkable and can easily be ignored because it's just there occupying those that central portion of the continent, and you know, the coast, other locations don't need to think about it as much. So I think it really is just a combination of cultural perceptions, maybe informing academic studies, and then now finally in the last, you know, 10, 15 years, a response to that by renewing interest in the Midwest in an academic setting, and then, you know, of course, in the national discourse as well, particularly in the political arena.
Maybe the most obvious explanation for this under discussion, especially in TV shows and movies, is that most media is made by people on the East and West Coasts. We've got about a minute left, but how significant is that?
Sure. Well, real quick, just from the early 20th century on, again, another major Midwestern scholar, James Shortridge, notes that the major media outlets reported on how the Midwest differed from the East Coast, so underreporting on its cities and emphasizing its pastoral elements. This sense of the Midwest is a perfect place between the overdeveloped East and the still developing West in the early 20th century. And I think that perception lingers and filters into popular culture, which I can pick up on again in a moment if we need to take a break.
Well, we've just got a little bit of time left.
Oh, sure.
We mentioned the subtitle of the book, Nostalgia, Violence, and Regionalism. We'll carry this over into the next segment, of course. Why you set out to focus on those themes is, I think what I'd like to come back and talk about. We are talking to Adam O'Connicky. He is the author of the new book, The American Midwest in Film and Literature. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking to Adam O'Connicky, the author of The American Midwest in Film and Literature. He's also an editor of the Middle West Review, an academic journal. Today's show is a repeat, so we can't get your questions or comments to our guests like we usually can, but we would love to hear what you think. As a Midwesterner, do you think who we are or where we live is portrayed accurately or fairly? Have you seen something that made you proud or maybe something that made you cringe? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. Just before the break, we said we would touch on the subtitle of the book, which is Nostalgia,
Sure.
Violence, and Regionalism. Did you set out to focus on those themes specifically, or did that come up organically?
Those elements did come up organically through my objects of study that I gathered. So I was trying to take as wide a view as possible of just all the different types of materials and stories I could find about the Midwest. And over time, there seemed to be these recurring elements that manifested within those stories. Nostalgia and violence being two of them. Regionalism is more of just a shorthand for the kind of methodology, the kind of academic approach to the study of region. To talk about those first two, maybe I can backtrack for just a moment. And I'd mentioned that this project emerged from both professional and personal interests. And as I was writing this, this was one of those cases where I realized that I had actually long been interested in regional identity and nostalgia. It had been something that, in all different kinds of ways, just in my personal life, I had always been fixated on. And this book was an opportunity for me to really backtrack and work those things out for myself. And one particular case study that I ended up not writing about in the book, but that actually exerted a large influence on it, was an episode of the old TV sitcom News Radio, which is a NBC sitcom from the 90s. and it depicted the workers in a New York City-based radio station. And there's one episode in particular that I remember watching when I was a teenager, in which two of the characters, played by Dave Foley and the great late Phil Hartman, were stranded in a St. Louis airport. And they, Phil Hartman is the consummate East Coaster who's dismissing everyone around him and acting arrogant. And they encounter all these local Midwesterners who are overtly friendly and seem to be naive. And over the course of the episode, it's revealed that this is kind of an act put on to deceive these out-of-towners. And it culminates with all of them, all the characters getting drunk together and engaging this show me state hello ritual, which is invented for the episode, in which Phil Hartman holds out his arms and then is punched in the stomach by one of the local Midwesterners. It's a really fantastic episode. And, you know, seeing this as a younger person, I just found myself really interested that that's something that other folks think about, maybe the place where I live, the place where I'm from. It's not necessarily accurate per se, but the accuracy isn't important so much as the perceptions and the associations that the Midwest is presented as being staid, like this sort of polite, uninteresting realm, but then there's actually something beneath that placid surface. And that just dynamic of surface and then depth is something that really informed my work in this book. And so, you know, as I progressed to the project, again, nostalgia and violence kept being these two, you know, points in which all the objects I found were kind of orienting around, kind of circling around. In terms of nostalgia, it also comes from just some of my professional work that I began working on this when I was teaching at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and I had the opportunity to design a course on the Midwest in film. And we were trying to discover or figure out just how we could market a class like this, myself and some of my colleagues, how we can market this class to undergraduates. Because maybe for some, just saying the Midwest in film doesn't quite seem that interesting. So we came up with this title. It was recommended that I give it a sexy title. The course was Violence and Disorder in the Midwest. And so I like to think of it as Violence and Disorder in the Midwest in order to lure students in with this sort of sense of really engaging, interesting text that also had some commentary on Midwestern identity. And so just through designing that course and then talking about some of those materials with students, that started to give shape to my book project a bit. And it really was this sense of just the kind of performed exterior identity of Midwesternness, so to speak, like kind of stereotypical traits of what people seem to associate with the region, masking or covering over violent tendencies or violent behaviors just beneath the surface that would sometimes erupt in these unpredictable ways. Going back to texts as iconic as like the Coen Brothers' Fargo, which it's a movie that I really admire and enjoy, but one that I think is so overly associated with the Midwest that it feels a bit monolithic at times, that it towers over all the representations. So I would include that in the course, and it just sort of out of obligation that we had to cover it first, and then we can move on to other types of representations. But that too has a protagonist who's played by one of the major characters, played by William H. Macy, who's, you know, seems to just be this generically nice Midwesterner who's doing all these devious things, including orchestrating the kidnapping of his wife, which leads to her death. So I thought those, like I said, those back and forth between surface and then what's bubbling beneath that surface was something that came up in all of my materials, and violence is one of that. Nostalgia, oh yeah.
No, go right ahead on nostalgia.
Yeah, so that's another element that for me has just long been a personal interest. I've always found that I sort of think about places I've been, times that I've had. I'm always interested in places and the ways that we associate memories and past versions of ourselves with places. And so I just came to understand nostalgia as this phenomenon and really a force that shapes individual and collective experiences of time, space, culture, historical knowledge, and so on. And it had long, in many of my materials, both popular and academic in nature, it would just be said that the Midwest is nostalgic in some reason. And it would never really be fully explained. Like, what does nostalgia mean exactly within this regional context? And I wanted to dig in and really figure out how, in a very critical and rigorous way, we could make sense of nostalgia. how nostalgia, as I said before, is this force that really shapes American culture, how that could be attached to a particular place, what the origins of that were, how it manifests in a variety of different forms, that it can be individualized nostalgia, it can be a sense of broad national nostalgia for maybe this outdated form of life, as like the Midwest often has attached to it. So all those things were aspects of how nostalgia and violence emerged from various case studies.
We're talking with Adam O'Connicky. He's a lecturer of English at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh and author of the new book, The American Midwest in Film and Literature. Indiana gets mentioned pretty early in the book.
It does.
page 2, to be exact. And you're referring to parks and recreation. And you said along those lines, the Midwest has been constructed as a space of simultaneous attraction and repulsion. And so in the case of Parks and Rec, I mean, that and that's why you bring it up. It's used for laughs, of course.
It is.
After pouring through all of this film and literature that you looked at for this book, I want to ask whether you think in where humor is concerned, and especially used in this way, whether the world is laughing with us or at us.
You know, I think it really depends on the individual case study.
To me, it seems like a little bit of both.
Exactly, right. But I think with a show like Parks and Recreation, it's good-natured, that Parks and Recreation is this series that is just sort of fundamentally optimistic, that all the characters have dignity, even the ones who they kind of, you know, make fun of a little bit more within the series, and they all are essentially fundamentally good people, if eccentric a bit. Even the kind of antagonists of the series end up exposing this kind of soft-hearted side. So I think it really is this warm-hearted embrace of a particular vision of the Midwest, one of a smaller city culture. So it's not really a small town or rural. It's maybe a city like where I live now, like in Oshkosh, that's a 60,000 type community. And in the series, you know, some of the moments where it's maybe that area of repulsion is when the protagonist, Leslie Knope, often has forums with townspeople, and they'll just engage in sort of all sorts of outlandish behavior and say these bawdy non sequiturs, and they seem just kind of like misfits in a way. But the core cast are all decent, kind people who, you know, I think a lot of people when they watch this series get a sense of comfort from it and would just want to spend time with all of them, to be honest. And again, it's also a show that, as I said, it has this sort of optimism to it, this this spirit, this maybe of its era, like it ran from 2009 until 2015. And since, you know, it came off the air right before the primary season began for the 2016 election, I think we've really seen a sort of sharp turn in national discourse since then. So not to overstate the way in which Parks and Recreation is commenting on national dynamics, but perhaps in some ways it might reflect maybe a sense of optimism that, you know, is being fought for now or debated.
You write about Kurt Vonnegut, and you quoted him. When you brought him up was in sort of a very positive way. You said, you were quoting him. You said, what geography can give all Midwesterners, along with the fresh water and topsoil, if they let it, is awe for an Edenic continent stretching forever in all directions. A very, very much Vonnegut quote. And then you expand on that by suggesting that the Midwest serves as a transitional space. In other words, we're often looking out at what serves as a border to the Midwest, mountains to the east, west, and south, and to a degree anyway, and water to the north with the Great Lakes. And I personally like being a landlocked, flatland Midwesterner because it makes me appreciate that kind of scenery when I do get to visit it. Is that mindset and that sensibility part of what you're looking at, sort of in the you open the book that way?
Yeah. For me, that notion and that Vonnegut quote in particular, it really speaks to the contradictions inherent within ways in which people think about the Midwest and talk about their place within it. But on one hand, yes, it is positive. It's this sort of connective tissue between different places, between different regions, this place in which sort of all facets of American life exist. even if the popular image sometimes ignores some of them, like, again, ignoring urban hubs ranging from Chicago to Detroit to Indianapolis to wherever the case might be. At the same time, I open up that particular chapter with a quote because I do love Kurt Vonnegut, but I do that, again, academic trick where I just have to kind of complicate things a little bit. And that line, like Edenic continent, just in that phrase, it somewhat elides the preexistence of Native American populations before the United States was even founded. And I use that as a lead into my conversation on Frederick Jackson Turner, whose work is massively influential, I think, for both academic and popular understandings of Midwestern identity. And much of his work is founded on this premise of either treating Native Americans in overtly racist and stereotypical ways, or framing North America as this vacant place that was then filled up by settlers of European origin. So those dynamics are all kind of always swirling around, that we have this sense of the contemporary Midwest, this place that, in a very positive way, is, for at least some associations, holds the nation together, that it has all these great, wonderful qualities of hardworking, authentic, genuine people, things that are even depicted in a show like Parks and Rec. But then there's also a history of displacement and shifting of indigenous populations at the same time. And that quote kind of, in short form, encapsulates many of those dynamics.
We do have a question from Daniel on Facebook who says he would love to hear your thoughts on the Hudsucker Proxy by the Coen brothers, which includes what Daniel sees as a mean portrait of Anderson, Indiana. Have you looked at the Hudsucker Proxy?
It's been a while since I've revisited the Hudsucker Proxy. It's a good reminder that I need to go back and rewatch it, maybe for another project. I can certainly speak to, again, just the Coen brothers' ambivalent relationship to the Midwest that appears in several of their films. And I apologize for deferring here, but so we have obviously Fargo and that sort of stereotypical treatment. And based on reporting of the time, I found some news articles that suggested local inhabitants of North Dakota and upper Minnesota were somewhat displeased with that overtly, in some ways, overtly cartoonish depiction of the region. I recently revisited Inside Llewyn Davis, which is largely set in New York, but there's a significant moment in which he journeys to Chicago. And it's basically this low point in his life, arriving in this Midwest metropolis in which it's windy and cold, and just the elements themselves seem oppressive and overbearing. Or another Midwestern-based Coen Brothers film, A Simple Man, or A Serious Man, I should say, also has this sense of a sort of Midwestern professor whose sort of mundane life just kind of falls apart. And it's a sense of the Midwest as a place of disorder and chaos. So certainly the Coen brothers, and like I said, it's been some time since, too long since I revisited the Hudsucker Proxy, certainly cast maybe that more repulsive aspect of the region as opposed to that welcoming or inviting depiction of the region.
I want to spend the last few minutes of this segment touching on the Middletown study of Muncie, Indiana from 1929. And you referenced this in your book. Just about anybody who went to Ball State in Muncie, like myself, has heard of this. And that's doubly true for sociology majors from there. And I checked that box as well. For people who aren't familiar with the Middletown study, what did it look at?
So it was, as they put it, a study in modern American culture. That's the subtitle of the book. And they have, for my purposes, I was especially interested in what they stated, what their stated goals were and what their stated methodologies were. That in the study itself, they were seeking to understand cultural change in America, and that they wanted what they put it as a place located in that common denominator of America, the Middle West. And so even as early as 1929, which is when the first volume of this came out, and they did release a second follow-up study, I think 1936, that they are already identifying the Midwest as being this place of averageness somehow. And that's part of that long-standing association of the region, that it somehow encompasses something that's authentic or average or genuine that other regions perhaps don't have. And for me, those associations don't necessarily hold up. I think every American is authentically American, no matter where you might live or what your background might be. But for them, they're buying into that perception. They chose Muncie because they wanted, as they put it, a city of a certain size, which was in this sort of mid-level range, 25,000 to 50,000 population. They framed Muncie as somehow being both representative but not typical. And so that odd, almost paradox of framing stood out to me as further fitting into that ongoing narrative of the Midwest as being a space with malleable meanings. And famously, they wanted a city that had a small minority population, a small foreign-born population. And so that is something that other scholars have certainly troubled since the study first came out, that they're actively ignoring diverse elements of the American population in order to focus on this more homogeneous community. And that, too, is a way in which I think the Midwest identity has been reduced to a place that's more exclusively white instead of actually fully recognizing all the different populations that occupy the central region. In fact, after Middletown came out, there have been subsequent academic studies on just the African-American population of Muncie and just the Jewish population of Muncie. And that was one of the reasons why in that particular chapter, when I write about Middletown, I wanted to pair it with a work by Richard Wright, his novel Native Son. So at the same time that they're writing about cultural change
I think we might have to leave it at that for now, but okay. We will be back with more from Adam O'Connicky, the author of the new book, The American Midwest in Film and Literature. We are back in just 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion with Adam O'Connicky. He's a lecturer of English at the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh and the author of the new book, The American Midwest in Film and Literature. Today's show is a repeat, so we can't take your questions or comments, but we would always love to hear from you. Send us ideas on what we could cover on the show. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Adam, before the break, we were talking about the Middletown study of Muncie, Indiana, and some of your criticisms and some of the criticisms that have been shared in the 90 years since it came out. And I had to rudely interrupt you because we were close to break. But where were we on that? What I thought was interesting was that the study referred to white people who live there as Native Americans. And that could have been a term that is now archaic when referring to people, but at the time it was a little bit more accepted.
Yes, certainly. And, you know, I don't think that the Lynns were intentionally playing into this sort of history, but certainly the way that they frame what is authentically American, again, largely white, and as they put it, native born, is echoing the rhetoric of nativist movements from earlier in American history on to the present, a sort of reduction of who counts as American and who counts as Midwestern. And since those things are often intertwined, I think that's why that study is still so important. And so in my project, as I was saying, you know, they're ostensibly writing about cultural change in the midst of the Great Migration, and yet they're actively kind of ignoring those dynamics. So I wanted to at least pair their text with something else, which is why later in the chapter I write about Richard Wright's Native Son, which was published in 1940, but set in the 1930s and depicts a character whose family had sort of come out of the Great Migration of African Americans moving from the South to Midwestern cities and Eastern cities, just in order to further show all the different things that were happening at the Midwest at that particular era when I was writing, sort of Great Depression and World War II era, or the really pre-Great Depression, but 20s through through World War II. One interesting note that I do kind of enjoy, and one thing I do rather like about the Middletown study, is they take a closer look at the Muncie newspapers. And writing in 1929, they note that it's largely taken for granted in Middletown that the newspapers, while giving information to the reading public as best they may, must not do it in any way that will offend their chief supporters, namely the business class, and that the newspapers actively censor any adverse news about prominent business class families.
Oh my goodness.
So this really interesting way in which the Lynns on one hand are creating a vision of the Midwest that fits into pre-existing sort of stereotypes, and it almost seems like they're kind of following the wake of literary critiques of the Midwest by authors like Sinclair Lewis or Sherwood Anderson and Willa Cather, and then also zeroing in on ways in which ideas and values are also being established and reproduced through something as mundane as the daily newspaper. So I think those dynamics make Middletown just a remaining source of fascination for a variety of different types of scholars and readers.
I want to make sure that we get to an example of a movie that's set in Indiana that you took a long look at with your book. And also I want to make sure that we touch on news coverage of the Midwest. But before we do that, I want to get to a comment from Nikki on Facebook who says, I think it's fair to call us a flyover state, referring to Indiana, because most of the population lives on the coasts and there are many coast-to-coast flights. However, I would never agree that life here is gray, drab, or dull. I've lived in many places and I've come to appreciate the rich fabric of community life where people come together and donate their time and treasure to make the community better. I've found my group of intellectual and liberal friends. The internet and media are great equalizers, and I no longer think we're 20 years behind the coasts. That last point about the internet is an interesting one. Do you think that modern technology has had an impact on how familiar people are with how the Midwest really is?
I certainly think it's important for people who may have previously felt isolated due to just geographic constrictions. And so, yeah, certainly that plays a role in expanding the boundaries of how people can situate themselves in the world and in relation to both their immediate geographic parameters and sort of larger context. And yeah, as Nikki wrote, I certainly am not endorsing or embracing the view of the Midwest as being this great oppressive place. It really is just me kind of unpacking some of those associations. That what's fascinating about this place is it is kind of, it's everything. There are some times when it can seem pretty bleak here.
Yeah, I mean, what we're talking about,
just a lot of gray terrain, and then other times in which, yeah, that very, very vibrant and beautiful. Even to cover my book, I think kind of captures that dynamic where there's this bleak, looks like like late March maybe, Wisconsin landscape that's kind of, you know, no organic life, traces of snow, but then the sky is this gorgeous pink sunset. And I think those contradictions make the Midwest an interesting place.
Let's look at a movie set here in Indiana. David Cronenberg's 2005 film, A History of Violence, starring Viggo Mortensen. This obviously gets into the violence portion of the book's subtitle.
It does.
It's set in the fictional town of Millbrook, Indiana, and you point to this as another representation of the idyllic Midwest. And how does the movie use that as a plot device?
Sure. So part of this is what I think David Cronenberg is bringing to the material. And the film itself is actually an adaptation of a graphic novel that was published by the Vertigo imprint of DC Comics. And Cronenberg has this great quote in an interview about his purpose for making the film. And he says that exploring this sort of seemingly straightforward nature of Millbrook is that he wonders, what does it take to support that perfect little town? What outside of that town, outside of that country, has to happen in order for it to exist? And over the course of the film, he, of course, kind of suggests that there needs to be this sense of violence and willingness to tolerate sometimes extreme acts in order to preserve a superficially placid exterior of this community. For those who haven't seen the film, David Cronenberg is an iconic Canadian director who's most known probably still for his work in the genre of body horror, these films in which people undergo sort of horrific mutations due to scientific experiments, drug use, disease, whatever the case might be. But really, his films are about identity transformations. And with A History of Violence, he gets away from that overt body horror to exploring the workings of this protagonist who's essentially kind of two people in one, not in that cliched split personality sort of psychological thriller sense, but someone who gave up his old life as an enforcer for a Philadelphia-based mob and intentionally tried to redesign his identity in order to blend into a small Indiana community. And so this character who was Joey on the West East Coast and Tom in the Midwest explicitly talks about his transition, that he had to work to become a Midwesterner. And in a sense, he's throughout the film really reflecting on an idea of regional identity at times maybe being something that you put on, that you perform in some sense. And this idea of performativity and regionalism really resonated with me. It was something that once I started to write about a history of violence, a few other different aspects of my project clicked into place. And it also harkens back even to that news radio example that I mentioned a short while ago, that there's this exterior performativity, this exterior sort of presentation of niceness, of politeness, of not being sophisticated that might hide something underneath. And that because Midwestern imagery is just taken for granted as being self-evident, that's what it is, it's plain, it's normal, it can mask those things. So for Cronenberg and Viggo Mortensen starting the film, I think together they're working to show just how many layers there can be beneath a superficial exterior. Kind of like Tom, Joey, that character is almost like the Midwest, a symbol of the Midwest in general, that there's a lot of different things happening all at once. and when he comes into this community, he essentially like dresses like a character from any kind of working class or middle class Midwestern set sitcom. So he looks like he could have walked out of, say, an episode of Roseanne or the old series Grace Under Fire. He wears jeans and a plaid shirt, just kind of standard attire that I think people maybe lazily associate with the Midwest. Not that those aren't things that people wear here, and not that those aren't things that I wear, but they're not like the only thing that that people have is their attire and their personas.
Adam O'Connicky is the author of the new book, The American Midwest in Film and Literature. And speaking of a history of violence, and you mentioned director David Cronenberg and how he's known for body horror. I think what's interesting about the tone of this movie is that it makes us just as uncomfortable as the body horror that he portrays in the other movies that he's known for.
Absolutely. Part of the tension is that, of course, the history of the violent past is revealed. And so by the time the movie has begun, this protagonist, Tom, has a wife and two children, this kind of, again, superficially normal life.
Exactly. And a lot of that has so much to do with the setting in the Midwest as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And the wife has this odd, there's that term, attraction repulsion to Joey, just as we see in other Midwestern narratives. And she comes to recognize, it seems, that her nice family life is dependent on his violent past. And of course, mob enforcers from the East come to sort of take Joey back, take Tom back for retribution. And he uses his violent faculties to defend the family. And so Cronenberg himself is someone who, while often depicting violence, is very critical of violence, not celebratory at all of violent acts. And he wants us to think about how problematic it is that here's this character who hasn't actually ever sort of atoned for the things that he's done in the past, and now he's enacting further violence in order to protect this new life that he's kind of created wholesale. Cronenberg, I think, has a line about some of the violence in that film where there's moments when we sort of feel happy that there's, you know, some individuals who come into Tom's diner and attempt to rob the place and then to assault and kill some of the occupants. Of course, Tom leaps into action and stops them, but we see this grotesque aftermath of the violence. And Cronenberg talks about wanting to contaminate our enjoyment of the violence, that what might seem like an applause scene in which people in the theater or watching home are eager to say, here's this likable character defending himself. We actually see the ramifications of that. And it's quite nasty and unpleasant. So the film is very, very ambivalent about its character, about its protagonist, and about all of the things that he does in order to preserve this superficial, you know, identity of Indiana small town community.
I want to move to the way the Midwest is portrayed in the news. And you say that this pursuit of the Midwestern ideal, which was used as a plot device in A History of Violence, it's made its way into politics, and you referenced the election of 2016 as a good example of that. What do you mean?
Sure. And really, it goes back even further. Just thinking of like 21st century presidential elections in, say, the 08 and 2012 elections, you would hear just phrases like Main Street versus Wall Street. And just the two-word phrase Main Street seems to serve as a stand-in for an entire swath of the country. And again, Main Street denotes small townness, I would say, you know, smaller communities. It doesn't necessarily speak to say, the Midwestern communities of Milwaukee or St. Louis or Cleveland. And yet it would just be the default. The Midwest is Main Street versus this kind of predatory Wall Street. And those sort of things, I think, have just become even more expanded since the run-up to the 2016 election and the wake of the 2016 election, that major news outlets who previously might not have taken a closer look at Midwestern dynamics became fascinated by who these states were supporting, especially swing states like Wisconsin, which is very polarized. I think we're one of the few states that have state senators or senators who are drastically opposed to one another. Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson are sort of opposite areas on the spectrum, and yet they each have widespread support in the state. There's not really a consensus here. And so what I've seen in just the last, you know, five-ish years is this ongoing kind of rhetorical move of, here the Midwest is this place that needs to be discovered. So 20-ish years after The Onion satirically discovered the Midwest in the late 90s, now we have major news outlets also coming and discovering the Midwest, sometimes through, you know, parachute journalism, where someone will just drop in and take a snapshot of, like, the local diner and see whoever they can find to give them a soundbite. Other times through more in-depth and detailed analyses. And part of the rhetorical moves is that this is the place of authenticity, the place of, like, the real America that's been overlooked or lost, which, again, is just kind of reiterating regional and national myths that have been in place for more than a century now, which to me is really fascinating. So there's a lot of different studies out there and in outlets from, you know, like The Guardian, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, to more academic work that seeks to recognize how there's a symbolism to the Midwest, how it isn't just something you can empirically observe, but it has these kind of, again, abstract properties, something I mentioned before. It exceeds just geographic parameters and maybe population demographics and has this other meaning in American culture. And I think that's what both the media and politicians are often riffing on when we see rhetoric circulating in all different kind of political forums. You know, one study in particular by political scientist Catherine Kramer, I think, resonates. She has a book called The Politics of Resentment that came out in summer of 2016, right before the election. And she had done this about 10-year study of rural associations, rural political views in Wisconsin. And her thesis, her idea, is that the geographic place in which we live, especially in rural areas, might supersede individual concerns or ideological views, that just a place identity informs how we situate ourselves in relation to other people. And so for her, it means there's this tension between urban and rural places and an urban versus rural divide that she talks about, and how that sort of tips over into outright resentment amongst different types of communities, different types of places. And I think that's something that maybe a lot of politicians can recognize. And she herself has written about how this, what had begun as just a state study, really has ramifications for understanding politics on a national level. The idea of resentment being something that can be fomented and then harnessed by various politicians. So certainly in the rhetoric of someone like Trump, who demonizes, you know, people of color and immigrants and all sorts of different populations, he's kind of riffing on that idea of resentment that someone like Kramer identifies in her own work. And it's tied to nostalgic understandings of place.
Adam O'Connicky is the author of the new book, The American Midwest in Film and Literature, Nostalgia, Violence, and Regionalism. Adam, thank you so much for your work, and thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks again for having me here.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Be sure to subscribe so you always know what we're talking about. Tomorrow we'll learn about local efforts across the state to help Hoosiers get through the pandemic. There's a lot of good happening in Indiana, and we hope to lift your spirits tomorrow talking about it. Until then, we're on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.